Hi, it's Scott with you on Thursday, February 19th. I'm reading from the Washington Examiner, the issue of February 4th, 2026. And this is the lead editorial in that issue entitled Spanberger's Costly and Unconstitutional Assault on the Second Amendment. Democratic Virginia Governor Abigail Spanberger has 4 years to mess up Virginia with left-wing policies, but she's not wasting any time. Within her first week in office, she signed an avalanche of fringe progressive executive orders seeking to remake the swing state into dark blue California. The state's Democratic Party has another target in its sights, that being the Second Amendment. Much of the proposed new legislation is unconstitutional. If passed, it would also turn law-abiding citizens into criminals overnight and cost taxpayers millions of dollars. Within days of the session's opening, Democratic lawmakers in the Virginia General Assembly introduced no fewer than 15 pieces of legislation restricting the rights of citizens of the Commonwealth to keep and bear arms. Some of those proposed laws seem harmless enough, such as requiring the safe storage of firearms in households with minors. But most are not okay. Many measures resemble anti-gun laws that have long existed in states like New York, New Jersey, California, and other locations with high urban crime. They would, no doubt, prove as ineffective in Virginia as they have elsewhere. For example, expanding the waiting period between purchasing a firearm and receiving it would do little to address violent crime. Criminals, being criminals, don't concern themselves with laws, whether they be gun laws or laws about anything else. Many studies show that most repeat violent offenders don't buy firearms legally. Existing federal legislation has long prohibited them from doing so. This bad policy would make it harder for law-abiding citizens to exercise their rights, but wouldn't prevent criminals from getting guns. That means that while the bad guy gets his weapon, a peaceable and law-abiding mother would be delayed in protecting herself and her family from a stalker or an abusive ex. Virginia doesn't need more gun laws. It certainly doesn't need Senate Bill 749, which is unconstitutional, and unworkable. It would be onerous for taxpayers and law enforcement agencies and would fundamentally alter the state's gun laws by banning the sale of so-called assault-style weapons. What, you might ask, is an assault-style weapon? Well, the short answer is that it is whatever the Democrats say it is. The definition offered by the bill's sponsor encompasses most modern firearms, including some designed nearly 100 years ago. The legislation prohibits the sale or ownership of any magazine with a capacity exceeding 10 rounds. This includes the vast majority of guns owned by Virginians and, for that matter, most gun-owning Americans. On a 9-5 party-line vote, the Virginia Senate Committee voted to advance Senate Bill 749 without a grandfather clause. This means that if the bill does become law, thousands of Virginians will become criminals if they don't turn in their firearms and magazines. Since laws are only as good as their enforcement, the law would require mass confiscation of private property. This is impractical and unworkable. And it promises to create burdens and hazards for law enforcement agencies already stretched thin and overworked. It's also blatantly unconstitutional, according to former Attorney General of Virginia Jason Miaris. By removing the grandfather clause with a simple stroke of the pen, countless law-abiding citizens who have never committed a crime can be punished with up to 12 months in jail, all for believing in their right to keep and bear arms, he said. He's right. Much of this legislation was vetoed by Spanberger's predecessor, former Republican Governor Glenn Youngkin. Many of the proposed bills are unconstitutional, contravening recent Supreme Court decisions, such as NYSRPA versus Bruin. Virginia Democrats aren't only advancing legislation that will strip Americans of their rights, but they're also proposing a big bill for taxpayers. At a time when Virginians and others are worried about rising costs and disorder, Democrats in the Commonwealth of Virginia are intent on increasing both. This is another Examiner editorial headlined, Democrats' Judicial Warrant Requirement is Backdoor Amnesty. Senate Democrats are threatening to shut down the government again, this time claiming that reforms must be made to the Department of Homeland Security before they will approve spending that includes DHS appropriations. Specifically, the party of the left is demanding that the law be changed so federal law enforcement officials must get a judicial warrant before arresting any illegal immigrants. This represents a clever and cynical demand that would functionally end all interior immigration enforcement, which has always been the Democratic Party goal. Under current law, immigration enforcement personnel may obtain an administrative warrant to arrest and detain an alien not authorized to be in the United States. Furthermore, another regulation empowers certain named immigration officials, including Border Patrol watch commanders, to issue such arrest warrants. This is not a new power. This is how interior immigration law has been enforced for decades. Once immigration law enforcement personnel have obtained an administrative arrest warrant, they're legally authorized to arrest and detain the named illegal immigrant. This appears to be what Border Patrol was attempting to do to Jose Huerta Chuma, who has been charged with domestic assault and infliction of bodily harm before he ran into a donut shop and the patrons inside barred the door. Now, armed with an administrative warrant, immigration law enforcement may ask a property owner to let them in and arrest the person they are pursuing. They're even allowed to say they have a warrant to arrest the person. But they may not enter the property by force or tell the owner of the property they have a warrant to enter and search the premises until they have a judicial warrant that says they may do so. Since the Border Patrol agents who were chasing Huerta Chuma had no such judicial warrant to enter the donut shop, they waited for backup. And that is when Alex Preddy and his activists surrounded them, shouting epithets and blowing whistles. Democrats want to require judicial, not administrative, warrants for all immigration arrests, which would make all interior immigration enforcement impossible. That's because mere illegal presence in the country is not a crime. Crossing the border illegally is a crime that is expunged after 5 years under a statute of limitations. There's no way immigration law enforcement can prove to a federal judge when and where an illegal immigrant may have crossed the border. This means the only way Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or Border Patrol, could arrest an illegal immigrant is if he or she first committed another federal crime. So, for example, if ICE wanted to arrest and deport an illegal immigrant who had been arrested for a DUI, it would be unable to get a judicial warrant because DUI is a state law. Under the Democrats' proposed judicial warrant mandate, the only realistic way an illegal immigrant could be arrested and deported would be if Border Patrol caught him or her in the act of crossing the border unlawfully. Anyone who made it past that moment would, for all practical purposes, be shielded from removal permanently. Such a policy would amount to the largest mass amnesty in American history, which is what Democrats have wanted all along. By insisting on judicial warrants for all immigration arrests, Senate Democrats aren't reforming immigration enforcement, they are eliminating it. Mere unlawful presence, a civil violation, cannot trigger a judicial arrest warrant. The result would be de facto amnesty for millions living in the interior, leaving Border Patrol and ICE with authority only at the border. This is not due process. It is open borders policy wrapped in legal procedure. Here's a letter from the editor of the Washington Examiner, Hugo Gurdon. It's entitled, Trump Should Stop Britain's So-Called Stupidity. Heading for a friendly business-seeking visit to China, Britain's Prime Minister, Keir Starmer, claimed he need not choose between his hosts in the communist dictatorship and his ally, the United States. This is worse than misguided, for it applies a veneer of impartiality to an administration that, in truth, sides with the tyrants against Britain's and America's interests. It is tellingly odd to adopt an even-handed approach toward a tyranny that only 5 years ago tore up a treaty with Britain so it could suppress freedom in Hong Kong. Britain's recent experience is of China's barefaced lying and betrayal. So why did the Prime Minister recently approve China building its biggest European embassy in the heart of London? It will put a massive hostile spying operation 3 feet from cables transmitting money transactions into and out of London, which is the biggest financial hub in the world. When, not if, China wants to disrupt the West, it will be ideally placed to do so. Starmer is also determined to perform what President Donald Trump this month called, quote, an act of great stupidity by ceding sovereignty over the Chagos Islands in the Indian Ocean to the Chinese vassal state of Mauritius. The biggest of those islands is Diego Garcia, the site of a joint military base from which the U.S. has strike capability across the Middle East and other strategically vital regions. Britain is doing this despite bipartisan and independent opposition in Britain to a deal that will cost billions of dollars and dismantle its territorial possessions, despite the Chagos Islands defending and projecting Western power, despite their never having been ruled from Mauritius, despite Chagosians wanting to remain British subjects, despite their being descendants of Africans enslaved by the French and freed by the British, despite their having no ethnic or cultural relationship with the ethnic Indians of Mauritius, and despite China having a policy of building military bases on any outcrop of rock or coral it can lay its hands on. It should surprise no one that this fiasco is attributable to efforts by left-wingers who are ashamed of the West's history and greatness and who are determined to dismantle them. Starmer and several close and sharp friends from the so-called human rights world are essentially giving China the chance to build a new advanced military operations base and denying self-determination to a vulnerable people because they're ashamed of Britain's past colonialism. It involves an odd mixture of arrogance and self-hatred, but we can no longer be surprised by it, for we have again and again seen its extraordinary power to distort moral and strategic calculations. It is glaringly present, for example, in the mass importation on both sides of the Atlantic of migrants from incompatible and hostile cultures. It is there, too, in the left lionizing terrorists and condemning Israel for defending itself since October 7th, 2023. The single strongest hope for the people of the Chagos Islands, for strategic sanity, for impeding China, and for the continued strength of the West that Diego Garcia represents, is that Trump will nix that handover. Britain is under a treaty obligation to the United States to retain sovereignty, and Trump should make it do so. If he does not, he'll be allowing Britain to learn and act on the Chinese lesson that international treaties may be broken with impunity. This article is from the magazine section Your Land, and it's titled NBA Political Lecture Season is Back. It's written by Zachary Furia. Do you want your sports spectating experience to come complete with political commentary from a bunch of random athletes who don't know anything about what they're lecturing you? Well, it's time to party like it's 2020 again, because the NBA, the National Basketball Association, is back in the political arena. After the Border Patrol shooting of Alex Pretti in Minnesota, the NBA decided it should make the shooting all about itself and its brand as the wokest sports league in America. The league postponed a game between the Golden State Warriors and Minnesota Timberwolves, citing what it called safety concerns, as if Border Patrol agents would be stalking the streets of Minneapolis prepared to shoot NBA fans. By postponing that game one entire day, the NBA successfully inserted itself into the political world once again. Sports journalists, who love to talk about anything other than sports, flocked to every NBA player or coach they could to ask them about their thoughts on the use of force involving lawless open borders protests, and those athletes and coaches happily gave them the political content they craved. It was amazing to watch the turnout and peaceful protests, the unified voice that was here, NBA star Stephen Curry said of protests that were declared an unlawful assembly by Minneapolis's police chief. Donovan Mitchell of the Cleveland Cavaliers chimed in on the fabricated story of Immigration and Customs Enforcement using a five-year-old as deportation bait. The child had been abandoned by his illegal immigrant father as he fled agents. Mitchell admitted he didn't know the full story, but he still wanted everyone to hear his uninformed opinion. The best was San Antonio Spurs star Victor Wembanyama, who said he was, quote, horrified by the, quote, murder of civilians, unquote. He's a 22-year-old, born and raised in France, who plays his professional basketball in Texas. The Spurs were not in Minneapolis when the shooting of Pretty happened. They were in Texas, preparing to play a team from New Orleans. And yet, we had to be subjected to Wembanyama's opinion, because it wouldn't be the NBA if every sheltered millionaire athlete didn't dump their Democratic Party-approved opinion on you at every opportunity. The National Basketball Association is a special kind of league, the kind where every major name in it thinks they're smarter than the league's audience, and that everyone is dying to hear their identical political opinions. With President Trump back in the White House, the NBA has secured itself another presidential term of political commentary that all basketball fans will have to listen to, whether they want to or not. This next article from the Your Land section is entitled Peak American. As recently as 2009, the scolds were still warning us about a world with too many Americans. The Census Bureau then predicted a U.S. population of 400 million by the year 2050, with an expected 2025 population of 357 million. Given that Americans per person produce many times more carbon dioxide emissions than people in developing countries, the New York Times warned in 2009, growth in the United States has added significance for climate projections. Well, the numbers are in, and we're far short of that projection. We barely grew in 2025 and ended up just below 342 million, according to the latest Census Bureau figures. So how does the major media handle that issue? U.S. population growth sputters as immigration stalls, said Axios. U.S. population growth slows sharply as immigration numbers plunge, the New York Times blared. The immigration numbers plunged by more than 50% from the previous year under the aggressive anti-immigration policies of President Trump, explained the New York Times. Immigration minus emigration in 2025 equaled 1.3 million, compared to the 2.7 million in 2024, which was the final year of Joe Biden's open borders experiment. But to put it in historic context, last year's 1.3 million net immigration is still more than the pre-Biden peak, which was 1.24 million in 2016. In other words, net immigration in 2025 almost returned to normal levels. The bigger story was the decline in new babies. More American babies were aborted in 2025 than in any recent year. Also, the birth rate in the country has fallen almost every year since 2007. In that year, 4.3 million babies were born in the U.S., while in 2025, the number was about 3.6 million. That's the lowest total since 1979. Here's another way to look at it. Former President Biden increased our population by importing a record number of illegal immigrants. Donald Trump has not reversed the baby bust, but has reverted immigration to the mean. This isn't a happy story. In 17 states, the census numbers show more people died in 2025 than were born. New data from the Congressional Budget Office suggests that the U.S. will hit the more deaths than births line in the year 2030, and thus only immigration will keep our population flat or growing. When will the U.S. population begin shrinking? On that score, you can't rely on the official projections because they all assume a rebound in birth rates, although all experience shows that low birth rates don't self-correct. They instead lead to even lower birth rates. A realistic guess is that the U.S. population will start shrinking before the year 2050. This means that if you are younger than the age of 60 right now, you'll experience the peak of America's population, and it's all downhill from there. This story from the Your Land section is entitled Hollywood Needs More Groundhog Days. It's written by Con Carroll. Trapped inside our home recently, my family was in search of a snowy movie we could watch together. After rejecting Alive, The Empire Strikes Back, and The Shining, we settled on Groundhog Day, which famously features a blizzard trapping Bill Murray's Phil Connors in Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania. Essays have been written treating Groundhog Day as a cinematic primer on Buddhism or Stoicism, and they're not entirely wrong. Phil, who's trapped in an endless loop, learns to master his impulses, detach from selfish desires, and find meaning in service to others. There are overlapping themes, but these interpretations miss the true driving force of the movie. Stoicism treats romantic attachment as a possible threat to inner equilibrium. Buddhism goes further, seeing desire itself as the root of suffering. The Buddha himself famously abandoned his wife and children. In both traditions, spiritual progress is tied to a loosening of personal longing. Yet the film Groundhog Day suggests truth lies in the opposite direction. Romantic love is not portrayed as a distraction from virtue, but as an inspiration for it. The character of Phil does not become a better man by extinguishing desire. He becomes better because he channels his desire into becoming a better person. At the start of the film, his interest in Rita, played by Andy McDowell, is shallow and acquisitive. He wants to get her the way he gets everything else, through charm, shortcuts, and manipulation. The time loop gives him the ultimate pickup artist fantasy: infinite retries, perfect information, and no consequences. And every attempt fails. Each time Phil uses knowledge of Rita's preferences to manufacture a fake persona, she senses the fraud. His turning point comes when he stops asking, "How do I get her?" and starts asking, "How do I become someone worthy of her?" That shift reframes the entire movie. Phil learns piano, studies poetry, and throws himself into helping others, not as a grand romantic performance, but as part of becoming a fuller, more generous human being. Love pulls him outward. His concern expands beyond his own boredom and frustration to the needs of the people around him. Rita functions as a moral horizon, not a prize at the end of a quest, but as a vision of the kind of woman he must grow into actually deserving. This is a powerful message in a culture where many young men oscillate between cynical detachment and desperate neediness. Some retreat into irony and emotional distance, convincing themselves they don't need love at all. Others chase validation through status, sex, or performative masculinity. The movie Groundhog Day offers a different script. Romantic love is neither a game nor a weakness. It's a school for character. The character of Phil becomes a good man, not just by serving the world in general, but by becoming capable of loving one woman well and being worthy of being loved in return. His salvation is relational. He escapes the loop not when he perfects himself in isolation, but when he has grown into someone who can enter a mutual, freely chosen romantic bond. That vision feels increasingly rare in modern movies. The romantic comedy, once a staple of Hollywood storytelling, has sharply declined over the past two decades, squeezed out by sequels, superheroes, and horror. Where romantic comedies were once one-third of all releases, they now make up just 5%. In giving up on romantic comedies, Hollywood hasn't just abandoned so-called meet-cutes and witty banter. Hollywood has largely stopped portraying romantic love as a path to maturity, mastery, and happiness. Groundhog Day stands as a reminder of what that older storytelling tradition understood, that becoming worthy of love is one of the most demanding and transformative journeys a person can take. And it can be funny, too. This article is entitled "Trump Voters Do Not Want to Appease China. The White House Should Listen." It's written by Michael Lucchesi. He is the founder of Pipe Creek Consulting. Also, he's an associate editor of Law and Liberty and a contributing editor to Providence. In a recent interview with Fox News, President Trump defended giving hundreds of thousands of Chinese nationals visas to study in the United States, arguing that the tuition fees from Beijing more than make up for the potential espionage risks. The president even claimed that his Republican base supported this open-door immigration policy. "MAGA was my idea," Trump said. "I know what MAGA wants better than anyone else." But when it comes to China policy, Trump is perilously out of step with conservative voters. New polling released by the Vandenberg Coalition reveals that while Trump voters generally support his peace-through-strength approach to foreign policy, they have been disappointed by many of his moves toward China specifically. Shockingly, the polls found that only 18% of Trump voters said they were the most satisfied with his Indo-Pacific policy in 2025. If Trump hopes to rally his base and save the Republican Party from a wipeout in this year's midterm elections, he should start by rethinking his relationship with America's greatest adversary. His voters clearly believe that the Chinese Communist Party presents the most clear and present danger to U.S. national security. According to that poll, nearly three-quarters of the president's supporters rated the CCP as an extremely high or high threat, ahead of both the Islamic Republic of Iran and Vladimir Putin's Russia. At the same time, though, 70% of poll respondents were not completely satisfied with the administration's progress on responding to CCP aggression. Evidently, certain policies are misaligned with voters' priorities. Trump would be wise to correct his course. One way that voters said Trump could improve was regarding TikTok. In a rare act of bipartisanship, Congress passed a law which Trump signed and the Supreme Court later upheld to define the Chinese-owned social media platform as a foreign adversary-controlled application and mandate its divestment from CCP-controlled entities. But instead of enforcing the sensible measure, the Trump administration pursued a shady deal with China, the full details of which have not yet been released to the public. Leaving aside the questionable constitutionality of that move, it's clear that unscrupulous dealings with the CCP could cost Trump dearly in terms of public trust. According to the Vandenberg poll, 66% of Trump voters believe the public has a right to know the terms of that deal. And a whopping 92% of respondents said they have major concerns about TikTok, especially with the app's collection of Americans' data and how the CCP could use it. Forcing TikTok's parent company to sell the app or banning it entirely would be far more popular than giving our most powerful rival a back door to American tech and culture. Of course, the same is likely true for Chinese students in the U.S. While Americans are no doubt a friendly and welcoming people, the Vandenberg Coalition poll shows that we're also wary of Chinese espionage and influence operations, as well as intellectual property theft. There are better ways to support our higher education sector than to prop up failing institutions with CCP blood money. And if sending their students to American universities is so important to CCP officials, Trump should use that pressure point to secure bigger concessions from the regime on everything from trade to human rights. For a man with a reputation for driving hard bargains, Trump seems strangely conciliatory when it comes to China. As important as TikTok and student visas are, what Trump voters worry about most is Chinese President Xi Jinping threatening to invade Taiwan. Three-quarters of Vandenberg Coalition poll respondents said they believe it is in America's vital national security interest to prevent China from invading Taiwan. Just 10% believe we should not respond at all to a potential invasion. Trump voters clearly understand that U.S. leadership is key to a safer world. Simply giving in to the CCP demands would be a betrayal of their instincts. Sadly, it seems that some within the Trump administration are less convinced about the merits of defending Taiwan. In September, isolationist figures persuaded the president to stop a $400 million arms deal with the island nation. And last summer, Elbridge Colby, Trump's Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, strained relations with the United Kingdom when he told the British to send an aircraft carrier stationed in the Pacific back home. These are not the kinds of actions an administration should take if it's dedicated to denying and deterring a Chinese invasion of Taiwan, or if it wants to convince voters it is pursuing peace through strength. It's disappointing to see the president adopt such weak policies, because it was during his first term that competing with China became America's top strategic priority. From taking bold action to subvert China's covert activities within the U.S., to building up our security architecture in the Pacific, the first Trump administration pushed for a whole-of-government approach to countering the CCP. Trump's successor, former President Biden, failed to maintain that momentum. The Democrats' China policy was defined more by bumbling incompetence and cowardly self-deterrence. Instead of putting the U.S. on a competitive footing, Biden and his team sought to appease China in order to avoid conflict. During this period of weakness, China became more and more aggressive. From a series of attacks on Philippine vessels to threats against Japanese territory, Xi moved to shore up his geopolitical position in the South and East China Seas in order to prepare for an invasion of Taiwan. Even recently, CCP officials have made it very clear that their ultimate goal is revolution in Taiwan and beyond. And as Xi seeks to achieve regional hegemony in the Pacific, he has provided industrial, military, and diplomatic aid to America's enemies, such as Russia and Iran. Now, Trump is at risk of repeating Biden's mistakes of appeasement. Zach Cooper, who's a senior fellow at the Conservative American Enterprise Institute, warned recently that both potential and actual capitulations on trade, security, and other issues would be putting China first. Cooper wrote in a provocative Time magazine essay that we should hope for a genuine Sino-American stabilization. But the Trump administration is falling into a classic trap of interpreting nice-sounding phrases and strategically meaningless Chinese promises as fundamental improvements in the bilateral relationship. Another part of what makes Trump's pivoting on China so shocking is that it differs greatly from his approach to other national security threats. That Vandenberg Coalition poll has shown that for months, voters have overwhelmingly supported the president when he stands up to America's enemies and empowers its allies. 86% of his base said they agree with his strategy to contain Iran and restore peace in the Holy Land. And most appreciate the bolder steps he's taking to help Ukraine end the Russian invasion. Demonstrating strength and resolve in those regions has energized his base. There should be no doubt that Trump could accomplish something similar by walking away from China's bad deals and shoring up American power in the Pacific. It's well past time for the president to stop listening to the well-coiffed establishment figures in his administration who are seeking to restrain him. As the president himself noted at a news conference last year, his position comes with truly global responsibility. Despite the squawking of D.C. isolationists, the American people understand that putting America first means embracing leadership. As the Vandenberg Coalition's poll found, 90% of Trump supporters, including 89% of those between the ages of 18 and 29, said that it's vitally important that the United States remain the strongest country on earth. While a crisis is certainly brewing in the Far East, it's not too late to reestablish deterrence through American leadership. And if one thing is clear, it's that the people elected Trump because they wanted him to be bolder than his Democratic predecessors on issues of national security. They're tired of the D.C. elite's decades of retreat and appeasement. They want their president to demonstrate real strength. The question is, will he listen to them? This next story is entitled, "We Are All Nixonians Now: What Trump Really Has in Common with Our 37th President." It's written by Jay Caruso, who is a writer who lives in West Virginia. Read a comparison between Presidents Donald Trump and Richard Nixon, and more often than not, it begins and ends with scandal, abuse of power, and corruption. The term Watergate has become synonymous with all of that, and people often use it to draw a direct line between Nixon-era abuses of power and those of today. But those parallels obscure a more consequential comparison for conservatives, but not necessarily the Republican Party. The connection between Trump and Nixon is not in temperament or misconduct, but in how each understood the role of government in shaping economic outcomes. This comparison is instructive precisely because it cuts against modern assumptions about Republican economic policy. Nixon governed a Republican Party that looked very different from the ones Americans associate with conservatism today. Economic debates inside the GOP had not yet hardened into doctrine, and the post-war consensus that the government had a legitimate role in managing economic stability remained largely intact. Skepticism of federal power existed, but primarily among activists and grassroots organizations, as well as publications like the National Review. However, it had not yet become a fundamental principle for the GOP. That context matters because it explains how Nixon governed while in office. By the early 1970s, the U.S. was facing rising inflation, slower growth, and mounting pressure on the post-war Bretton Woods monetary system, also known as the gold standard. Nixon viewed those pressures not as problems that would eventually work themselves out through market forces, but as political and economic threats that required direct government action. In 1971, Nixon enacted a nationwide 90-day wage and price freeze, followed by a system of ongoing controls administered by federal boards. This was not a small intervention. It was the federal government directly setting wages and prices across the economy, something that would later become politically untenable within the Republican Party. The policy was intended to thwart inflation and stabilize the economy, but it also marked one of the most direct assertions of federal control over prices and wages in modern American history. The Nixon trade policy followed a similar logic. That same year, he imposed a temporary import surcharge, or tariff, as part of a broader effort to protect domestic industries and address balance of payments pressures tied to the unraveling of the Bretton Woods system. The policy structure differed from later tariff implementations in that it was temporary, but the approach remained the same. Market outcomes were not treated as hands-off. They were subject to government action when economic or political conditions demanded it. Nixon's comfort with using government for economic purposes extended beyond just prices and trade. Rather than dismantling the New Deal or the Great Society, he consolidated and expanded parts of it. He signed legislation creating supplemental security income in 1972, expanded food stamp eligibility, and advanced a guaranteed income proposal through the House twice via the Family Assistance Plan. Although the proposal ultimately did fail in the Senate, the effort itself put Nixon outside the tenets of free market capitalism and market dynamics. Nixon's presidency reflected a managerial view of the economy. He didn't reject capitalism, but felt it needed to be actively overseen and, in some ways, controlled. It took less than 10 years for that approach to be eclipsed. In 1964, Ronald Reagan delivered his "A Time for Choosing" speech on behalf of Barry Goldwater during Goldwater's presidential campaign. That address marked a significant break with the post-war consensus that had shaped Democratic and Republican economic policy for decades. Reagan framed government intervention not simply as ineffective, but as fundamentally corrosive. He said, "This is the issue of this election, whether we believe in our capacity for self-government or whether we abandon the American Revolution and confess that a little intellectual elite in a far distant capital can plan our lives for us better than we can plan them ourselves." For Reagan, markets were presented not just as engines of growth, but as part of the guarantee of individual liberty, because, he said, a government can't control the economy without controlling people. Reagan carried that framework into the California governor's office and later to the presidency. While divided government required compromise, Reagan's approach to compromise was tactical rather than ideological. His often cited 80-20 rule captured that distinction. If he could get most of what he wanted, he accepted partial victories with the expectation that policy would continue moving in the same direction. Give and take was necessary, and he understood the process. He was willing to negotiate over implementation, timing, and legislative detail. He was unwilling to legitimize the idea that government intervention in markets was desirable in itself, and he often spoke against it in his speeches and writings. Even when he worked with Democrats on things like tax reform or Social Security, those compromises allowed him to reinforce his economic worldview. Reagan's view of government and free market capitalism would reshape the Republican Party for decades to come. His presidency obliterated the model Nixon used just years before, making the case that government should shrink, get out of the way, and allow markets and people to do the work. This was the economic framework Donald Trump inherited and busted through like a bull in a china shop. Trump's approach to economic policy has many similarities to Nixon's, with the added bonus of public bluster and bravado that would have made Tricky Dick blink. The easiest to understand is tariffs, not only because they've become central to Trump's presidency, but because they reflect one of the few, if only, positions that he has held consistently for decades. Long before entering politics, back at a time when he was building casinos in Atlantic City, New Jersey in the 1980s, Trump publicly argued that foreign countries, particularly Japan, were, quote, ripping off the United States through trade. So it was a position ingrained in his mind long before he considered running for president. That history matters because it distinguishes tariffs from Trump's other policy positions, where he is likely to pivot at any given moment. Trump has long viewed trade deficits as evidence of weakness and tariffs as a corrective tool. While president, he's treated them not as temporary bargaining chips, but as long-lasting policy instruments and a bludgeon meant to punish countries that cross him. He repeatedly asserts that tariffs are paid by foreign countries, even though they are not. It is part of why he uses them as a punitive measure. He operates under the false assumption that countries are writing checks to the U.S. Treasury. The reality is that domestic importers bear those costs and pass them through supply chains, ultimately causing consumers to pay higher prices. In functional terms, tariffs operate as a tax. His love affair with tariffs differs from Nixon's in scope and permanence, but the logic is comparable. Market outcomes are not neutral or self-correcting. Trade is not left to institutional norms or economic theory. It is something the state could and should manage directly when outcomes are viewed as politically or economically unacceptable. The consequences were predictable. Trump's trade war with China imposed high costs on American farmers, particularly in export-dependent regions that formed the backbone of his political coalition. But rather than retreat from the policy, Trump responded with tens of billions of dollars in direct federal payments to offset those losses. In short, it was a form of corporate welfare, justified as compensation for the economic effects of federal trade policy. Trump's willingness to intervene extends beyond trade. He repeatedly and publicly pressures the Federal Reserve to lower interest rates, challenging long-standing norms around central bank independence. Presidents have historically sought favorable monetary conditions, but Trump does so openly, framing interest rate policy as responsive to his whims rather than as insulated from them. He also advanced proposals designed around helping the working class that would have been politically improbable within the Republican Party only a decade or so earlier. These include a recent proposal to cap interest rates on credit cards, extend mortgage terms to 50 years to address housing affordability, and plans to ban institutional investors from purchasing single-family homes. Trump has also taken to having the federal government hold equity stakes in private companies. The reaction from the Republican Party has ranged from quiet disagreement in some quarters to silence to open acceptance. Traditional conservatives and free market advocates have been horrified, while populist voters cheer on the moves. On several of these issues, figures on the left, including independent Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, have found themselves aligned with Trump. Sanders' support for aggressive state intervention has been ideologically consistent. Trump's comfort with similar tools highlighted how far Republican economic assumptions have shifted. Trump did not introduce this governing instinct to American politics. He revived one that had largely fallen out of favor within the GOP. Like Nixon, he treats government power as a legitimate means of achieving economic and political ends. Unlike Reagan, he doesn't frame intervention as a necessary evil to be minimized through compromise. Seen this way, the Trump-Nixon comparison becomes less about scandal and more about economic governance. Both presidents operated on the assumption that markets exist to serve national and political goals, and that government has a role in shaping outcomes when markets fail to do so. This is why the constant return to Watergate analogies ultimately obscures more than it clarifies. Corruption is easy to condemn and process. Economic governance is more difficult because it forces the Republican Party to reconsider principles that it has spent decades treating as settled. Nixon's downfall did not lead to a wholesale rejection of his economic policies. Reagan's rise did. What Reagan accomplished was not simply a policy shift, but a reframing of markets and state power that endured long after tax cuts and the end of the Cold War. Trump governs outside of that framework. Seen through that lens, Trump is less an aberration than a stress test. He exposes how contingent the party's commitment to Reaganite economics has become once stripped of rhetoric. When intervention produces political and electoral wins, Trump won Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin twice, while George W. Bush could not, resistance fades. This tension will outlast Trump himself. But the question is, how far will it go within the entire GOP ecosphere? Most of it all centers on Trump. And while some believe that once he's finally gone, the GOP will slowly find its way back to a more free market outlook on economic issues. That being said, with a populist Republican voting bloc making a lot of noise, the question becomes whether the party can shift in another direction. That makes the Trump-Nixon comparison useful not as a warning about scandal, but as a guide to where the party may be headed. Right now, it's mostly about the person, but it should be about competing visions of what government is for and what its role is. On that question, the Republican Party has yet to provide a clear answer. These next two articles are from the Washington Secrets section, written by Rob Crilly. Raytheon ignores Trump's dividend demand. Less than 3 weeks ago, President Trump blasted defense companies for their lack of urgency, as he saw it, in fulfilling crucial military orders. He ordered them to stop paying dividends and to curb what he called the overcompensation of executives so that they could funnel money into production. I've been informed by the Department of War that defense contractor Raytheon has been the least responsive to the needs of the Department of War, the slowest in increasing their volume, and the most aggressive spending on their shareholders rather than the needs and demands of the United States military, Trump wrote on his Truth Social platform. The company's chief executive was asked about it on the January 27th earnings call, and he showed no sign of giving ground. Christopher Calio said, "As it relates to capital allocation, again, we recognize our shareholders rely on our dividends, and they've come to expect our dividends. We've been paying them for decades on a quarterly basis, so we remain committed to the dividend," he said. This story is headlined, "Why Melania Hopes Her Movie Will Unite America." Fresh from her message calling for unity in Minnesota, First Lady Melania Trump offered similar sentiments as she rang the bell at the New York Stock Exchange to promote her new movie entitled Melania. "Visual storytelling and beautiful music create memories for a lifetime," she said. "What do you remember when you hear the Rolling Stones or Michael Jackson? Films bring families and friends together, sitting side by side, sharing a collective moment. In doing so, they will not simply watch my film, they will participate in a great American tradition and become part of our nation's history." We'll gloss over what people might remember when they hear the name Michael Jackson and leave the snark to less charitable rivals. And finally, from Rob Crilly, Republicans have drawn up a list of the hard-left Democratic candidates who might just help them retain the House in November. And we've seen it. While conventional wisdom holds that the party that controls the White House will get a shellacking in the midterm elections, Republican strategists believe all is not lost. Their reason for optimism is Democrats' ability to pick weak candidates as runners shift leftward to win their primaries. The socialist insurgency is reshaping the foundation of Democrat primaries, and it's reshaping the battlefield, the document says. It's becoming clear that Democrats' biggest threat to winning back the House is their own base. It is still the Democrats' election to lose, however. The president's party has lost seats in 18 of the 20 midterm elections since 1946, and they only need to flip five in order to take the House. Just don't bet against Democrats' ability to pick left-wing candidates that struggle to win over centrist or anti-Trump Republicans. Here are some candidates on the GOP hit list. They include Randy Villegas, challenging Representative David Valadao in the 22nd Congressional District in California. Manny Rutinel, who was challenging Representative Gabe Evans in Colorado's 8th Congressional District. That matchup is currently rated as a toss-up. Amar Campa-Najjar, who is challenging Representative Daryl Issa in California's 48th Congressional District. That matchup is also rated as a toss-up. William Lawrence, who is challenging Michigan Representative Tom Barrett in that state's 7th Congressional District. That is also rated a toss-up. John Kavanaugh, who is running to replace retiring Representative Don Bacon in Nebraska's 2nd Congressional District. That matchup leans Democratic. In the analysis, it says, State Senator John Kavanaugh has a rich history of far-left voting in the Nebraska unicameral legislature. In his own words, in Congress, he says he will join the Congressional Progressive Caucus on the front lines of the fight to protect Social Security and health care, lower the cost of living, and hold Donald Trump accountable when he cheats Americans. And the final race is the New York 17th Congressional District, where Democrat Peter Chatzky is challenging Representative Mike Lawler. That is also rated as a toss-up. I'm Scott. It's been a pleasure being with you today. Look forward to connecting with you again soon.